We're not just another radio station. Well, yeah, we are. Cable Radio WEBR.
On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory common ownership development. It is broadcast live from WEBR, Fairfax, Virginia. Join us as we explore the world of common ownership development, the fastest growing form of residential development in America today. This housing concept includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes that are part of a mandatory homeowners association. Unfortunately, this type of housing is not as utopian as its advocates would have us believe. Living in a mandatory homeowners association means giving up part of the American dream. It means giving up constitutional rights and control over one's most valuable asset, one's home. Living in a mandatory homeowners association means leaving the American zone. WEBR Fairfax Radio, you're on the Commons. I'm Sue Bartholomew. And, you know, folks, once in a while, the good guys do get recognized. And one of those good guys today is with us on the Commons. His name is Blaine Carneal. Blaine is an attorney from Florida. And he is the recipient of the Broward County Legal Aid's Lawyers Care Award as Pro Bono Lawyer of the Year in 1999 and the Florida Bar President's Pro Bono Service Award in 2002. Blaine, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Blaine, you've got this is quite impressive here.
Well, I've been lucky. I was faced with a situation in which I ran across some very desperate people who needed some help, and I was naive at the time with respect to the problems they would face. And of course, then once you take on a case, you can't very well let it go. So I walked into the quicksand. I couldn't get out. That's all.
Well, I'm really glad that you were there, because you're one of a handful of people who will take on these cases. And I get calls from you won't believe this, will you, Blaine? But I get calls from around the country from people who are desperately looking for an attorney to help them.
Well, I believe that. I probably get 5 or 6 phone calls a day. That's just in South Florida, with someone with some type of problem involving their association. I certainly can't handle all of those. Some can be helped merely by a few comments or answering questions or sending them to somebody else. But I'm always frustrated with the limited number of people I can help, with the literally thousands of people that do need help. And it's very frustrating to be on this side of the fence, I might say.
I'm on the same side as you are, Blaine, and I'm not an attorney. So when I get these calls, it's, you know, I live in a small town, small part of rural America. I live in a homeowners association. I did not know I had a homeowners association, and now this is what they're trying to do to me. What can I do? Can you help? And, you know, finding an attorney is like, it's just terrible. It's very difficult.
Well, there are reasons for that, and they're very practical ones. The first is very few lawyers develop a knowledge base about a concept where they can't make money doing it. And the limit is, well, that's me. Why spend all your hours and training in an area of law where there's not much money? The money to be made by lawyers in the association law is in behalf of the associations.
That's right. And there's a lot of money to be made there, isn't there? A
tremendous amount of money to be made there. I've always said, at this rate, meaning the effort I put in on a case and what little I make versus what my opponents are making for the little bit of effort they put in on a case, it's a battle of attrition, meaning it won't be long before they will be more and more successful and I'll have more and more of a difficult time. And that's just not true for me. That's true for most lawyers that handle unit owner disputes. It's just an overwhelming, it's an avalanche of opportunity for the association attorneys and a minimal opportunity for the unit owner attorneys.
I'm not going to ask you the question, but if you want to jump in and comment on it, you can. I was told by an attorney or actually I was told about an attorney who, again, a sole practitioner who did represent homeowners in, against their associations, that the industry, the association attorneys went in sort of, it sounded mafia style, where they went in and threatened to just blow this attorney out of the water in terms of drowning her in paperwork and discoveries and all of this other stuff so that she could not, so that she would not have time to basically take care of her paying clients, even though, you know, she worked with some of these homeowners. And so she stopped representing representing the homeowners completely.
Well, I think there are practical questions from that. I had a case. I'll make this a very brief story. With my indoctrination in this after trying 20 years of plaintiff personal injury practice was purely by accident. My secretary set an appointment with a person, and she was on my schedule. And I asked her what it was about, and she said, "Well, he's the brother of a former client. He's got a condominium problem." This was in 1996, and I said to her, "What in the world you set this for? I don't know anything about condominiums. I don't even know what one is." And she said, "Well, he's already here. Why don't you talk to him?" Well, he came into my office, and he presented this series of facts that his association had said that he owed $158, which he disputed because he had various proofs of payment. He said they'd been tacking on various late charges and interest and costs. The lawyers had filed a lawsuit, and now they were going to foreclose on his home, and they wanted approximately $2,700 in attorney fees and costs, and if he didn't come up with the money, he'd lose his home. They had a wife and four children. He was a cab driver and a part-time real estate salesman and a very nice fella. And I was naive. I was under the impression I could pick up the phone, ask the lawyer to reduce the fee, work out a payment plan, and call it a day. Well, what happened basically was they motivated me. They said, "We're glad that you called. Now we can charge your client another $75. And if your client doesn't pay 100% of what's owed, we're going to have him sleeping under a bridge."
You're kidding.
No, of course not. So I'm just not the kind of person to take, after 20 years of trial practice, to take that kind of talk lightly. So I went to the association, and I pulled all the records of the association, which consisted of an entire room of file cabinets. Under the statute, I was able to get copies of those records. I pulled them all. It cost me a few $1,000 to get a copy of all the records of the association. Began to study the condominium law and the statutes and case law. I was highly motivated, and I figured out that every late fee and fine that this association ever levied was unlawful, and that there had been a questionable attempt at amendment. I won't call it fraudulent, but let's just say questionable, to justify a late fee when they didn't have the authority for it. And so I brought a 550-paragraph countersuit class action lawsuit. Well, I was on the impression, too, that that kind of effort would bring them to their knees. Well, that did not happen, and I had to litigate with them for 6 years. The court certified my class action. It took me 6 years of litigation. Excuse me. And many hours. Ultimately, we succeeded. They settled with us after 6 years. But I think they really wanted to see, A, whether or not we could afford it, and B, whether or not I'd put up the time and energy necessary to prevail. So, to answer your question, the answer is yes, they can weigh you down with paper and distract you from the other clients and keep you from succeeding. But if you have the right case and you persevere, ultimately you can take a big chunk out of them. So that's what happened. That was 6 years, and that's how I got self-educated in condominium law, is basically by survival. Once we started this thing, I couldn't stop, and I had to figure out what to do and how to do it and stay with it until I succeeded. That's all.
You said you settled out of court.
That's correct.
Was that settlement made public, or was it kept quiet? Do you remember?
Well, it was public to the extent that all the class members were given proper notice. It was approved by a circuit judge in court. So that in that respect, it wasn't confidential. But I would say that in the context of the insurance company's attorneys, the association's attorneys. Of course, when I filed the countersuit, the association brought in their insurance counsel. So they were being paid by the insurance carrier, and the association was paying their association's attorney, of course, by passing special assessments for 256 people, and I was on my own against both of them. But by the end of that case, probably total cost of the case in terms of paying the class damages and all the different attorney fees involved were probably close to $500,000.
Wow.
That's three lawyers, 6 years, and a class that ultimately was approximately 225 people.
And I hope you got paid.
Oh, yes. I did okay on that case.
You did okay on that case.
It took 6 years. My answering your question about how they can overwhelm you is a true statement.
Well, I think, you know, the thing, I know that they play, you know, it's an economics game, but when they actually walked in and threatened her, it sort of brings to mind these B-rated movies where you see these mafia, the bad guys sort of walk in with their raincoats and, you know, their hats and their dark glasses, and they slink in and close the door and sort of sit there and say, now, if you don't drop this case, then, you know, we're going to do this, that, and the other to you.
Well, I can say it's intimidating, but I can't say anyone did that to me, and I guess maybe they knew me well enough not to, because that would have been an opposite effect than the one that they would anticipate. I'm just loony enough to that the more they talk like that, the harder I dig in. So I think they got the message of 6 years. I had them running all over constantly. I mean, I papered them.
He papered them. We're talking to Blaine Carneal. Blaine's an attorney in Florida who is the recipient of numerous awards, and he's staunchly on the side of the consumer, the homeowner, the housing consumer. Blaine, you've got another case that's currently in the courts, and it has to do with collections.
The Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, yes, ma'am.
Yes. And, you know, you and I have been talking a little bit offline. You want to tell us, first of all, why don't you tell us a little bit about the Fair Debt Collections Practices Act and what it means to consumers?
Well, I can only relate, I'm not an expert in the act per se. I can only relate it to the type of cases that I see. For example, I know the basics, and they are, of course, that the original debt collector, usually a collections company, or in this case, several years ago, the courts determined that the lawyers that are doing collection works are also categorized as debt collectors if that is a majority of their work or if they derive a significant amount of income from that purpose. And so they are under the same requirements, for example, as a collections agency. And the Fair Debt Collection matter is that the consumer should be free of harassment. The consumer should get a notice which defines the debt in such a manner that the least sophisticated consumer can understand the alleged debt and respond to it in a timely fashion. That they can ask the collection agent to verify the debt, meaning if they do not believe that the debt is valid or that they owe the debt, they can request, preferably in writing from the debt collector, please send me verification of the debt. And then that should stop, by law, that is to stop all collections activity for at least 30 days or until such time they have responded to your request for the verification of the debt. They have to send you a copy of the invoice or the bill or the statement from the original entity that created the debt to give you proper notice. The value of that is it buys you a little time, but the most important thing is that it gets someone to tell you specifically what it is, what debt it is that they're asserting that you owe. Because, quite frankly, sometimes with identity fraud, identity theft, sometimes with payments that you've made, the checks weren't properly accounted for. Sometimes you got a bill from a previous collections agency and you paid it. But now the creator of the debt still has it in someone's files, and they send it to another collections agency who's unaware of the fact that the debt was paid. So there are many legitimate reasons why the consumer is certainly has a right to know that information. And it is to stop the type of prolonged, incessant phone calls that might come or incessant letters. And it's activated by the very first notice that one receives. If that first notice the consumer receives is by phone, that is the first notice. If it is in writing, that is the first notice. Now, for the consumer, what's important about that is the first notice under the Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act constitutes the starting of a one-year statute of limitation. So any cause of action that one might have against a debt collector has to be filed in the court system within that 1 year from the very first notice. Many states have complementary collections acts. Florida has what's called the Florida Consumer Collection Practices Act, which is a state statute, which is complementary, and it has a 2-year statute of limitations. In respect to my particular case, our question was in respect to a notice letter. There are many aspects to it, and I won't discuss the specific defendants or the case itself. But in the general context, the weaknesses in the notice that we dealt with respect to a condominium or homeowner issue, was that the notice letter and or the claim of lien did not tell someone the day, month, or year they missed a payment. They simply asserted that as of this particular date, you owe X number of dollars. Well, unless someone is informed about the particular day, month, or year they missed a payment, it shifts the burden back to the consumer to scramble through 5 or 6 or 7 years' worth of checks to try to figure it out. And if you can't figure it out on your own, independently, in a very quick fashion, what's the natural reaction? To communicate with the law firm to tell you what the debt was, when it was. And, of course, in the communications, allow the deadline clock to run with respect to when they're going to file an action against you, and it allows them to bill you for communications with respect to the debt. So it sets up a scenario where the attorney fees can grow exponentially while you're still trying to figure out what bill I did not pay or what month or assessment I did not manage to pay. And so that was one of our key elements in our case was, you've got to, if you're going to ask me to pay a bill, you must tell me what day, month, or year I missed the payment. That seems fair. And if once you do that, I can check my records to see if your statement is valid or not. And if it is, I send you the check. I send you the cost of attorney fees. And we move on down the road. But if you don't tell me, and in the process of not telling me, create a scenario in which your attorney fees are growing exponentially, you put me in a more vulnerable position than is fair. And that's well provided for, we believe, under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. And another matter was the lack of definitive nature of attorney fee claims. And that was in the area of asserting a right to fees that had not yet been incurred but were alleged to be probable.
You're kidding.
No. The fees, anticipated fees is how they categorized it, and I found that to be improper. Even if your fees are high, they should at least be accurate from your own records.
Oh, we anticipate that you're not going to pay us for 3 years, and therefore, in the ensuing 3 years, we will be making somewhere in the neighborhood of $250,000. So that's what you owe. Is that what you're saying?
Well, that's an extreme statement, but it's the same concept. Yeah, there are certain things we're going to have to do shortly. You don't owe this right now, but we're pretty sure you're going to owe this, so pay us this amount of money to cover what we're going to have to do for you. If, in fact, you did owe a debt, and, in fact, we're entitled to attorney fees. And what makes it worse...
What a racket.
Well, that's
what a racket.
Very, very, very difficult to deal with. And what makes it even more difficult in Florida... If I may continue, might go on with this subject? Or?
Yes, please do. I'm sorry.
Well, what makes it more difficult in Florida, and I can't say, I've tried to check this in other states with their state law, and I believe with the exception of perhaps Texas or California, the Florida condominium statute is the most oppressive collections procedure in the country. Over, with the most oppressive collection's subject, which is one's home. For example, Florida has a provision of the statute at Florida Statute 718.116(3). It's called an application of payments process. Excuse me. And it says that once a delinquency is determined or has been asserted, that all subsequent payments shall be applied to cost, interest, attorney fees, then the assessment first due. Well, by rearranging that choo-choo train in the way that they have, that you must satisfy all claims to attorney fees before your subsequent payments, the new payment you're making for new debts that are incurred, will be applied to the first debt. So in that scenario, you can never get ahead of the debt because the association's attorney fees are growing, and it's not in the normal collections context where you said, okay, you owe me $200 for this bill, and as a result of my trying to collect that, you owe me attorney fees in amount of thus and so. The way this system is designed is that unless you satisfy 100% of the unilaterally asserted claim for attorney fees, it still appears that you're delinquent and they can continue their claim and march toward foreclosure and in the process continue to run up more attorney fees because you haven't satisfied 100% of the debt. And it's outlandish, and I think it's, in my personal opinion, no judge has agreed with me yet, but no judge has disagreed with me yet, and it's unconstitutional on about four different principles, in that no one has determined the merits of the case, no one has determined whether the fees are reasonable, no one has determined whether or not you even owe the money, and every check you're writing is not going to the association or going to satisfy the debt. It's going to satisfy, first of all, the ever-increasing attorney fees, and so when someone actually gets in front of the judge, it appears as though that the person owes significantly more if it takes 6 to 8 months to a year to get to trial, because the funds have been diverted from the payment of an assessment to the payment of ongoing attorney fees, which has also grown much quicker than the debt possibly could. So if you've got an assessment that's $200 a month, but the attorney fees are billing at $225 to $250 an hour, it doesn't take a genius to figure out that the biggest part of the entire process involves attorney fees. So if you owed $150 to begin with, now suddenly you owe $17,000 of attorney fees and costs if you put up any fight at all, and you've been paying your monthly assessment for the last 8 months, but it doesn't matter because it's all gone to attorney fees. It's become a drop in the bucket. So that, in fact, you've only diminished it. By the time your money diminished the attorney fees to any degree, they've grown six times greater than the money you paid against it. And there's a real question as to whether or not that violates a separation of powers question with respect to a judge has the only authority to determine who's prevailing party and whether attorney fees are reasonable. Whether or not there are due process questions involved, both on the federal and the state level, in terms of a taking of your funds without due process of law. And now, the practical problem in litigating a question of constitutionality is this, and that is, if you have a client whose only defense is to challenge the constitutionality of the application of payments, you can't possibly, as a lawyer, ask that person to take that case all the way up to the Florida Supreme Court, because the attorney fees would be a couple hundred thousand dollars. And you put the only one who would win would be the lawyer, and the person who would lose would be the person who'd lose their home. On the other hand, if you have a case that's winnable in any other circumstances other than challenging the constitutionality of the statute, you can't ask your client, when the other side is prepared to dismiss their lien, dismiss their foreclosure case, to put their house up as collateral so you can run a constitutional issue by the Florida Supreme Court. So you're in a case where the application of payment has been both taken out of context and is unconstitutional, but it can't be challenged in a practical sense, because to do so is to jeopardize your client's home, which defeats the very purpose for which they hired you, which is protect their home. If they sell their house or lose their house before you go to trial, then they don't have standing to claim the recovery of attorney fees and costs. So they can't be a prevailing party on attorney fees and costs because they lost standing, because they're no longer a property owner in their association.
Is there any way around this? I mean, you're painting a pretty grim picture, but I like the idea that, you know, if you can challenge it on a constitutional level, and I think you're talking about the federal constitution, which would then encompass everybody across the country, right?
Well, it would. Most of the constitutional questions I raise are both Florida and U.S. constitutionally based, due process and equal access to the courts, and
right,
separation of powers, those types of things. They could be raised by anyone, but I don't know what other states have an application of payments provision similar to the one in Florida. So they wouldn't. I mean, there would be no necessity for them challenging that if, in fact, that wasn't the statute in their state.
But I, whether it's the statute or not, I know it's something that's done. I don't know if it's the statute in Virginia. I should look that up. I do know that the attorneys across the country who represent homeowners associations will advise their clients to write their collections policies and list the hierarchy of payment as the attorney gets paid first. And then the costs, and then da-da-da-da-da, and if there's anything left over, it goes to the association. Yet these very same people, attorneys, are down there at the Capitol sort of lobbying and testifying for these extraordinary powers, saying that it's not fair for associations not to be able to collect money it is owed aggressively, because then you have the freeloaders that they who are not paying their fair share, and it's not fair to everybody else. In actual fact, I think the delinquency rate is so minimal that it's not that big an issue. What we're seeing is exactly the type of picture that you're painting here.
Well, let me comment on that for just a moment. Now, think about the practicalities of this. Let's say you have a condominium association with 200 people, and there are five people that are somewhat in debt. Let's say it ranges anywhere from 1 month to 2 or 3 months of delinquency. Well, if you pursue that vigorously, and you force that, and if in fact you've got let me back up. My approach would be, first of all, that the actual officers and directors of the association should be the ones taking a more proactive role in obtaining recovery for their association, i.e. a letter, a phone call, a visit to the person, and in a congenial manner explaining the circumstances and asking them to pay before the matter is turned over to the attorneys. Quite frankly, often the attorneys advise the association, when you've got a delinquency matter, turn it over to us immediately. Well, of course they want it turned over to them immediately, because it's a tremendous source of revenue. And if you lose one of those cases, I had a case a year and a half ago, where I resolved it, where ultimately the claim was like for $358, and ultimately they had to pay several thousand dollars to me. And that is true of other cases as well, not just with me, but with other lawyers, had to pay a fee to the unit owner's attorney for the defense of a case where the debt was not justified, then they paid many thousand dollars more than if you took the very few people who've been delinquent and let them continue to be delinquent for an entire year.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's a scale situation. All you have to do is lose one case where you've aggressively pursued a collections was not valid, or the records were not accurate, and you've lost as much as an association in attorney fees, not only to your attorney, but to the opposing counsel's attorney, than all the collections efforts combined for 5 years. So it's not really cost-effective to be too aggressive under certain circumstances. The other problem is, many times these associations' records are not accurate.
Yes.
they don't have an accurate record of the historical ledger. They don't keep an accurate ledger of the checks.
That's right.
Many times they create a scenario.
Mm-hmm.
They don't like Sally Jones because 2 years ago she ran against you for president. And so they hide the checks. They destroy the checks. They say they didn't get the checks. They create an artificial debt, which then they tack on a late fee, then your subsequent payment is being applied to an incomplete debt, meaning when you deduct the late fee, your second month looks like it's in arrears as well because you didn't satisfy the debt because you artificially attached the late fee. And when you complete that scenario, between the mismanagement and the improper bookkeeping and or the intentional shuffling of checks to create an artificial debt, people are at their peril, and they have to defend these actions.
We're going to take a short break. We're talking to Blaine Carneal, and we'll be back in just a second. Don't go away.
They want me to get rid of my dog. Can they do that?
I'm being fined for leaving my garage door open too long.
What are covenants? Do I have any rights?
Help, I feel like I've left the American zone.
If you want the answers to those questions, join me, Shu Bartholomew, and my guests on The Commons every Saturday from 2 to 3 right here on WBR Fairfax Radio. We'll ask the experts and we'll untangle the truth about what's left of our property rights. WBR, Fairfax Radio, you're on The Commons. I'm Shu Bartholomew, and on The Commons with us today is Blaine Carneal. Blaine is an attorney in Florida, and he has won a couple of awards for being the Pro Bono Lawyer of the Year. And I, from everything I've read and seen, it is a very well-deserved award. Congratulations, and thank you for helping out here, Blaine. I appreciate it on behalf of homeowners all over the place.
Thank you, ma'am. One more word and I'll be out of business.
No, we don't want that.
No, that's right.
We don't want that. You know, you have, and I think Florida used to be, and I'm going to guess that it still is, the number one state in the country for homeowner association type of living. Yet people are not particularly savvy when they move into this. What, in your opinion, is the greatest level of ignorance when it comes to living in a homeowners association? And what should people do to protect themselves?
Well, that's two different questions.
I know. I'm just going to sit here and shut up and let you take it.
Well, the two greatest areas of, let's say, a lack of education with respect to unit owners are these two things. One is that people are under the illusion that, mistaken illusion, that the fact that the real property is their homestead, or there's a constitutional protection for homestead, for example, is or is in Florida, that will preclude a foreclosure of their home. They basically believe, well, you know, my association can sue me, they can get a money judgment, but they can't take my home away if I don't pay my assessments. Well, in Florida, and I certainly can't speak for other states, but in Florida, that is not an accurate understanding. Because you take your house subject to the recorded covenants, and the recorded covenants, generally speaking, speak of foreclosure being handled much like the first mortgage, or speak of a lien being effective upon its recording, enabling a party to foreclose, then the fact that your property is your homestead will not be a deterrent to a court-ordered foreclosure of your home. And the second greatest area of need of education is in the area of the covenants themselves. When most people buy their homes and go to real estate closing, the lawyer across the table is passing so many papers back and forth, they can't keep up with it. And then they get a title policy and they get all their stuff in a nice big envelope, and the covenants in the same envelope. They fold them all up, they put them in a drawer somewhere, and they don't look at them again for 6 or 7 years or until a problem arises. Then when they take that out the first time was when a lawyer points out to them some violation that has incurred, or some debt that they have, they look at it and they scratch their head first and say, gee, I can't understand this. Mm-hmm. And then when they do understand it, they say, holy mackerel, if I'd have known they had these kinds of rights over me, I wouldn't have gotten into this place. Well, my first admonition there is, if you're going to close on an association piece of property, hire a capable lawyer and read the documents and ask that lawyer to explain certain scary parts of those documents to you before you purchase that home. Because if you're not content that you can live within the parameters of the authority that's created for those documents, then you better look for another place. So, I mean, those are two areas that are critically important.
Can I jump in here for a minute?
Yes, ma'am.
You know, that's fine. Understanding the recorded documents is no guarantee that you're not going to get yourself in a mess either, and I'm going to tell you why I believe that. Number one, most of the board members don't, you know, don't stick within the bounds of the governing documents. They don't know them. A lot of the attorneys who represent the associations won't bother to read the governing documents of that particular association and just give advice, just general advice. And thirdly, you don't know what the state's legislature is going to do. They'll come in and they'll, and I know they're not supposed to do this, but they do. They'll come in and they'll enact legislation that enhances and increases the powers of the association. And even though you may not have literally agreed to live under the regime of a little dictator, you may very well find yourself in one of those things anyway.
But let's take the fundamental subject of who understands the governing documents. I mean, many times the board, I concur with you, many times the board of directors do not understand the documents and don't, and what, if they do understand, attempt to plead ignorance about certain aspects that are the union owner's benefit. I have a case in Florida presently pending where an association's president unilaterally determined he wanted a homeowner to have the Winnebago parked in his driveway moved. And in the course of events, he did not send them a proper notice. He did not hold a hearing with a panel of other unit owners as required by the statute and required by their own covenants. He unilaterally created a lien for $29,000, billing the person $200 a day, not necessarily for the time frame in which the Winnebago was there, but they were billing for the time frame at $200 a day based on the failure to satisfy the first $200 letter. And my poor client, who came to me recently, has had his home tied up for over a year on a $29,000 lien in litigation where he's had to defend it, where, in fact, it was a matter of having a Winnebago sit in the driveway for 2 days. And so this poor guy with a wife and wants to start a new family can literally not sell his home because of the peril that he's in with respect to this association. And it was the unilateral act of the president who really set up his own sense of, so immersed in his own sense of importance. And but the problem with the court system is you can ultimately turn things around. But most court systems work very slowly in the context of the peril that you find yourself. So it might take you 6 months to a year to get something straightened up. And many people simply can't take that kind of time, either can't afford someone to defend it for them, or give up and say, look, I want to get out of here. I need to sell my house. I need to be transferred. I have other responsibilities. And it just, in someone's unilateral act like that, can literally mess up their entire life.
Well, you've heard of Winona Blevins, I'm sure. This is the 82-year-old widow in Texas whose home was foreclosed on. And the attorney, Marianne Rosen, who stepped up to defend her, also went through, and the first thing, and she, like you, did not know anything about homeowner associations. And she said, you know, the first thing you do, she was on the show a number of times, she said the first thing you do is you go in and you start digging in the association's records. She says, I can guarantee you that every single one of them is acting outside the scope of their authority. And she says, and that's where you start. You know, you just sort of force them to sort of act within the scope of what they're allowed to do, as opposed to just taking off and doing anything they please. And in that case, it was the treasurer, I believe, who made the unilateral decision to reject her check because she had paid it and to proceed with foreclosure.
I had a lady in Fort Lauderdale. I think she was in her late 70s. She lived in this place for over 17 years. She was a widow. She had made, on the first day of the month, of every single month for 17 years, she took her check and put it in a drop box near the association's building.
Mm-hmm.
Never missed a payment. They said that on one one particular month, they didn't receive her check. So they assessed her a $25 late fee. She immediately gave them a second check, but for the exact amount of the original bill.
Mm-hmm.
They then proceeded to take her next month's assessment and apply it to the first, deducting the late charge. So now she, in a technical sense,
mm-hmm.
she was alleged to be 2 months in arrears.
Right.
They sent it to the lawyers. The lawyers filed a lien and were threatening to file a foreclosure action and wanted approximately $1,800 in fees and costs. On it. Then, Matt, miraculously, they found the first check. Okay? So it was a situation in which someone was trying to take the home of a 77-year-old
mm-hmm.
ill widow
yeah.
over a $25 late fee that, in fact, she did not owe to begin with.
Yes. Yes, that happens so much.
To me, I'm ashamed. I am ashamed to be a lawyer when I hear a story like that.
And
I was a part of that story, and I helped turn it around. I grew up in a small town in Kentucky, and if a person attempted to foreclose a widow's house over a $25 late fee, I don't think they could practice law in a small town in Kentucky if the word got out they did that. But where I live, you know, it's just that's not taken as a serious offense. And what appalls me about the legal profession is we allow that to go on. A lawyer has such power in the nature of the licensing that he has, or she has, that if a client came into your office and said, I want you to sue Widow Jones, and I want you to foreclose on her house because last month she was 3 days late with a mortgage, I mean with a $150 assessment payment, I think you should say to that client, I'm sorry, I won't take your case. Maybe somebody else would, but I'll be darned if I'm going to take that kind of case. And that's the problem is there's not enough restraint on the part of the attorneys who scrutinize their cases because they're thinking only in terms of self-preservation and self-gratification as opposed to thinking in terms of the better societal good.
I think what you're talking about is ethics, and you have it, and they don't, and it just comes down to that. I mean, you're right. What sort of person morally would... It's morally reprehensible. I mean, what sort of person would go for something like that? But they do it. Unfortunately, they do. Blaine, I guess it's sort of a stupid question, but should associations have the power to foreclose?
I think they should, yes.
Oh, you think so?
I do. I think they should have the power to foreclose, yes. I don't think there can be a situation in which they do not have that capacity. But I think there should be tremendous number of stop gaps and constraints on them before they can succeed in that. But there are people. There are people who simply refuse to pay, and it is not right for the other unit owners to pick up their tab consistently for a long period of time.
Let's say that the association came to you and said, you know, she's sitting here and she hasn't paid for 3 years. Would you take her to court and collect what she owes? Do you think a judge would force me to pay?
Would force you to pay if you haven't paid 3 years?
Yeah.
Certainly the judge would.
So
I'd agree with the association.
And so would I.
We'd say you made every effort. You made calls. You wrote letters. You went to see them. You wrote three lawyer letters. You know, 3 years passed, Judge, and then we're talking about $14,000 worth of assessments here. Certainly, I think they should have the right to foreclose. But when you're talking about...
But Blaine, suppose, if the judge ordered me to pay and I didn't pay... is there some other way of dealing with it? Maybe garnishing my wages? Getting the money some way without... I think it's an extreme measure, foreclosing. I think it's just sort of using a cannon to swat a fly.
Well, and it's, in that respect, I disagree with you a little bit, but only at the extreme. I don't disagree with you at all under 99% of the circumstances I've ever seen. I have never had a client who came to me that asked me to defend them and hadn't paid in 3 years. I would not defend a client that hadn't paid in 3 years over a lien foreclosure case. It's just, I mean, the only ones I defend are the ones that didn't pay for 30 days or 60 days, or they did pay, and the association either you know, lost or didn't handle their checks properly. And so they're fighting for their life when, in fact, they have a legitimate defense.
Well, I think people who owe money should pay them. If you live in an association, you owe the money, and that's all there is to it. You have to pay. I don't know. It just is subject to too much abuse. There's no adult supervision, and I really can't foresee the government saying, okay, you know, we're going to provide some kind of adult supervision to make sure that you associations and you association attorneys do not abuse this power. It's just not going to happen.
Well, part of the problem, too, is I don't know where to start. I mean, in terms of how they manage their money. I mean, people become frustrated with an association that year after year passes a special assessment for one purpose or another, or they've been paying reserves for a number of years for a particular purpose, and they find out the money's gone for another purpose. It's been commingled. It can't be accounted for. Or they're not getting proper bids, or they're overspending or wasting the money. It's hard to turn your money over to someone who's wasting it on a daily basis and then not resent the fact that they're asking you to pay in a timely fashion. If you don't pay, they'll try to take your house away.
That's right.
I understand that. But the nature of the power is such that you can question those. Those are almost separate issues. If you when a client comes to me and says, for example, I don't think this special assessment was proper, or here's how they're wasting the money, and I don't want to pay my assessment next month as a result of that, or I didn't pay my assessment last month as a result of that, I say to them, pay the assessment, send them the check, keep a copy of it, clean the slate so that your home is no longer in jeopardy,
mm-hmm.
And then if you want to seek a declaratory injunctive relief, you want to hire an independent accountant, you want to sue the board of directors, you want to look at breaches of fiduciariality, you want to question management capacity, you want to challenge the fraud involved, then do it off the table so your home is not in jeopardy. But many people are of the impression, well, if I have this question, then because I have a question about the debt, I'm not going to pay it. That's a terrible position to be in. It's not a sound legal position.
No, I agree with you. I think that, again, if you owe the money, pay it. What I normally tell people, Blaine, and I don't know, you may not agree with this, is, you know, if you owe the money and if there's some kind of hanky-panky going on with the association, they mislay checks, they, you know, it's your word against somebody else's or whatever, I usually tell them to make a copy of the check and to walk it into the office and have whoever they hand the check to sign their copy that they have received the check and date it. So there's no question that it arrived at, you know, at five minutes past five when the 5 o'clock is the deadline or whatever.
Well, you know, you're right, but that's only for someone who's very sophisticated. I mean, 90% of the people that live in associations merely mail the check in with a coupon to whomever they tell them to mail
yeah.
it to.
Yeah.
And they don't keep a record of it. That's why, from my standpoint, the debt collector, the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act scope, which forces a debtor to tell you what month you missed a payment, is so imperative, because it does put someone on notice so that you can at least search your records to determine whether or not you, in fact, made a payment or not.
Is there anything in the Fair Debt Collections Practices Act that is particularly onerous to the collector and would impede his or her ability to proceed with their jobs?
I'm not an authority enough to say if there is anything in there that might. I can say that I haven't seen anything in the Act that would seem to be onerous would preclude their ability to collect the debt. But they may make an argument different from that on some small aspect of the Act. But the purpose is great.
Well, I've asked them because I don't know if you're aware of it, but they're lobbying very heavily in Washington, or CAI is lobbying very heavily in Washington to exempt associations and their collectors from the Fair Debt Collections Practices Act. And I have asked them exactly what it is they object to. How would this make their jobs that much tougher? I mean, is it because they don't You know, they want to be able to yell and scream at the homeowners. Do they want to cuss them out? Do they want to harass them? Do they want to abuse them? Don't they want to tell them what they owe? Do they want to try to collect under cover of darkness? And all of these issues that you sort of talked about, how is this going to make it that much tougher for them to collect? I mean, you treat people with respect. and they haven't been able to come up with anything satisfactory as far as I can see.
I'm sure their lobbyists are working on it. We have the same situation in the state legislature, which is even more difficult to deal with in the federal lobbying process, in that, you know, these sophisticated firms that do this work are willing to pay significant dollars to lobbyists to ensure that the system either remains the same if it's in their benefit or that it's not changed dramatically. But I will say this, a politician who gets in the front of the union owner parade when union owners are properly educated will have for themselves a great political future, because there are a lot more union owners than there are collection attorneys.
You're absolutely right, Blaine. Blaine, you know what? We're out of time. I want to thank you a lot for joining us. I want to wish you all the very best with your current case and all your other cases. And a speedy recovery from your cold.
Thank you. Gracious for you to call me. I appreciate the opportunity to try to talk to the community about unit owner issues.
I hope you will come back and give us some more sound advice.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you to all of you for tuning in. On the Commons was produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no big flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell. Why, our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings, closed in justice for HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home, yet the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, so tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.
Keeping the First Amendment alive.
WBR.
Cox Channel 37. Comcast Channel 26. Fairfax Cable and Internet Radio.
WBR.